Are we going to talk about Christmas movies like we do every time?
Yes, we are.
I knew we would.
Yes, we are. There's a question I'm going to ask you. I hope you're ready for it.
Oh, no.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for December 2018. I am your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by our own Saint Nick, Timothy Nelson.
It's true. I've been told I look like a young Santa Claus.
You do.
Yeah.
But it's also because of your compassionate spirit for those in need. And I really respect you for that.
Oh, thanks.
True story.
I appreciate it. Like the actual Saint Nick.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. I'll take it.
So Christmas is 1 week away from tonight, from the very night we're recording. I cannot believe it. Are you excited?
I didn't realize that. I am.
It's crazy. I love this time of year, though.
Are you going to read like the...
The Christmas story?
Yeah.
I would love to. Okay. I think our listeners would not dig it, but we could try.
I could do voices.
Yeah.
Like the puppets we talked about before.
Sure you could. No, man, it's Christmas. It's just magical. There's lights. It's great. But I'm like surrounded by all these deep theological thinkers that keep telling me that the coziness of Christmas is just a distraction and a way of looking backward when we're supposed to be looking forward. And I'm just like, you know what? I love my lights.
So here's the thing. Yeah. All the bah humbug, yeah, theologically minded. Terrible.
Come on.
Look, can't we like celebrate the fact that technically we're in Advent. We're not in the Christmas season.
Yes,
okay, I get that. Whatever. Okay, we have expectation and it's like a future expectation, a present expectation, a past expectation.
Right.
Okay, whatever. Got that covered.
Yeah.
Great. Read your lectionary text. Great. But really, like, isn't it a miracle that like there's like whole like millions of people that are celebrating the birth of Christ in weird kind of ways?
Yeah.
But still, like, we are celebrating, people that don't even follow Jesus are celebrating the birth of Christ.
Hmm.
That is pretty incredible.
I love that. Yeah.
That's kind of amazing.
I think it's beautiful. Good. So, Tim, we are going to close the podcast with a very important question. I'm going to give it to you up front. It is Christmas Eve, and you can only watch two Christmas movies. What would they be?
Okay.
That's the question. But we're not going to answer that now. I just want you to hold on to it in your head.
They can't just be any movie. They have to be Christmas.
They have to be Christmas movies, and you only get two of them. So think on that. Think on that, listeners. And that is the question we're going to close our show with. So something to look forward to. But first on the docket is our listeners' favorite segment. I'm assuming it's their favorite. I haven't like taken a poll or anything, but it's my favorite. And that is, of course, what have you been watching? So, Tim, please tell us. What have you been watching?
I've been watching lots of Netflix, actually.
Okay.
Surprise, right?
Yes.
I haven't been to the theater hardly at all. I've been watching the Coen Brothers movie that was on Netflix.
Yes. What's that called again?
Something Scruggs. I don't remember.
The Ballad of Scruggs or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what it's called.
It's a new Coen Brothers movie on Netflix. You can figure it out, people.
Yeah, you can find it. And it's an anthology. So basically, it's like five tales?
Something like that. Yep.
Five or six tales of the West. And they kind of have a theme that links them all, which is kind of desire and death, right? And so it's absolutely fantastic. The best part about that was I had read the short story. There's a Jack London short story that one of them is based on, the one that has Tom Waits in it.
Okay.
And I had read the story prior to seeing the film, and they give no credit to Jack London at all.
Oh, come on.
I know, so ridiculous. But they did such a good job at adapting the story that I knew prior to any dialogue, just based on the scenery, I knew what the story was, which I was just amazed by that. I was like, this can't be this. It is.
So you highly recommend the new Coen Brothers movie on Netflix?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
And I feel like Netflix is the perfect venue for the Coen Brothers,
yes,
because I don't think that you need to see the Coen Brothers, generally speaking, on a huge screen.
Yeah.
Come on. Like, most of their stuff, I mean, great if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fair. But I think most of their stuff is very heady, and you can handle that on a smaller screen.
Coupled with the fact that not everyone is as enthused as some of, you know, picking up and going out to a theater to see a Coen Brothers movie. So,
paying money for a Coen Brothers movie.
So it's like
people
the
aren't
perfect,
enthusiastic about.
Yes. So I think it's the perfect convergence.
Yeah, I'm like, if you think about it, like, how many Coen Brothers movies did you ever see in the theater?
Yeah.
I may have seen one.
We podcasted on one.
Hail Caesar,
Hail
right?
Caesar, yeah.
I saw one.
Uh-huh.
And there's a few that have kind of bigger... that seem like they would merit it, like Raising Arizona, just because of the backdrops and everything.
Inside Llewyn Davis was great because of the music. But
but like, honestly, it's not like, I'm not always so wowed by cinematography or technical achievement. Yeah. I feel like they're storytellers.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
So you don't necessarily need to see them in the theater.
Anything else besides the Coen Brothers movie?
I think that's it.
All right. Well, I got two for you. Just to keep Tim annoyed every month, I will talk about a TV show and then a movie. So first up, the show.
I am emotionally prepared.
You've been mentally preparing all week for this? Okay, good.
For you to...
For talk about TV. Yeah, just, I know.
I'm ready. Mm-hmm. I have no reservations regarding...
Doesn't seem like you're even frustrated. I'm so proud of you. Yeah. Awesome.
Go ahead, man. Go ahead.
Perfect. Here we go. I would like to draw your attention then to a show on HBO called Big Little Lies. Now, I'm a little late to the party as usual on this because everyone was talking about this like 2 years ago. But this show is amazing. It is a limited series and it stars Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern, like this all-star cast. It's written by David E. Kelley and it's directed by an up-and-coming powerhouse director in the TV world. He has done movies before. Where he did Wild with Reese Witherspoon. His name is Jean-Marc Vallée. He did this, Big Little Lies, and then this year he did Sharp Objects with Amy Adams, which a lot of people have been talking about. I've seen it. That is also good. But anyway, Big Little Lies is kind of dealing with the Monterey, California wealthy subculture of like wealthy moms who send their kids to private schools and all of
Monterey?
Their like... Yeah.
Really?
Is it not? Now, you're from California, so it was in... Set in Monterey.
No, Monterey, you can't afford to live there, nor can I.
Right. All the husbands are tech execs, you know, doing the next big thing, and they're all live by the beach and everything.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so they're sending their kids to private school, and they have all these, like, you think they have, like, the perfect life, but of course they have all these petty squabbles and then some really serious issues. And basically, David E. Kelley pulls a trick right from the start that just sucks you in, creates a mystery from the get-go that the whole 7 episodes seeks to solve, and it all is building up to this epic climax in the last episode that has you on the edge of your seat. It is one of the best shows I've seen in a long, long time. It was so good that I watched the whole thing again with my wife. And so I highly recommend Big Little Lies on HBO. You've probably already seen it because, like I said, I'm late to the party. Yeah.
Cool.
Secondly is a movie called The Favorite. This is by Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos. You loved him for The Lobster.
Oh, yes.
2 years ago, which I absolutely hated. I don't even know why I hated it so much. There's like sometimes a movie just rubs you the wrong way. I walked out of there feeling so just like I needed to take a shower. Gross. Yeah.
You were threatened by the greatness.
I probably was. So I did not like that movie, but I recently saw his latest feature, The Favorite, starring Emma Stone, Rachel Weisz, Olivia Colman, and it is a stunner, man. It's great. And in a lot of ways, what's interesting is it's very similar to The Lobster in that it's about a bunch of terrible people doing terrible things to each other with like no redemption. I mean, that's basically what The Lobster was too. But there's something about it this time that feels so much more profound. I think he's nailed this message home in a way that he didn't with The Lobster. And you leave walking away going, yes, all of these people's choices have led them into these private hells that they're now trapped in, that they're stuck in. And he really drives that home with this epic final scene. And I just walked away feeling very like contemplative. And I think that in and of itself became a moral center that I feel like The Lobster lacks. So I was really impressed by this movie, and it's just so well made.
So I have a private hell.
Yeah, do you?
Yeah. It's called when I make the decision to go to Chili's on Tuesday night.
Oh, my God.
I just wanted to say, because you were referring to private hells, right? Yeah. Where you choose.
I identify with that private
hell. So I make this mistake, because it's kids eat free night at Chili's.
Oh, no.
And I make the mistake every time thinking that this could be an idyllic experience.
Yeah, and that this could be affordable.
It could be affordable. Right. It could be this wonderful thing that, you know... It could be like Cheers, right? Yeah. We go in every Tuesday night.
Yeah.
So we bring our three kids in and they just freaking melt down, spill every, like if there's anything that's like liquid at all, it's like all over the whole Chili's.
And yeah. And then there's that excruciating wait between when you order the meal and when the food comes. And
yeah. And what do they do? They go to that little video thing and they like buy a bunch of games. And then I have to go, look at my kids bought a bunch of games and I didn't want them to. Can you take it off the tab? And they're like, not okay.
Every single time I eat out with my three kids, I realize it was a mistake in about 10 minutes.
It's a mistake.
Yeah. Every time.
You should just go make some fish sticks at home. Okay.
Totally.
That's 100%. The only way, but my private hell is Chili's Tuesday night, Miller Parkway.
Awesome.
With my kids. I just wanted to bring that up.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, appreciate it. So there it is, The Favorite and Big Little Lies. Those are my picks. All right. So moving on, some might be expecting us to cover a Christmas movie on our show. After all, Christmas is just 1 week away. But as I mentioned in our last podcast, this is the time of year, man. It's Oscar season. There are like great movies falling out of the sky into theaters every week. I'm seeing like three a week. It's just ridiculous. I should just live at the theater. I wish I could. It's outrageous. So this is the time of year where if we just took a whole month off to like review, you know, whatever, pick your Christmas movie, then we'd be missing out on a great film. So we will not be reviewing a Christmas movie. Instead, we will be reviewing one of the best films of the year to date. A movie that will be talked about come Oscar time, you can bank on it, and a movie that the critics have gone wild for. In fact, Time Magazine named it the best film of the year, and that is Roma.
So yes. My grandma's going to find that out when she reads Time Magazine.
Hey,
and Newsweek.
I have a proud Time Magazine subscriber.
I can just see your bathroom
every
right now.
Week.
I can see your bathroom just lined with Time
Magazine. Time Magazine and Entertainment Weekly are my magazines because Time Magazine,
place,
unlike Newsweek, still matters. Their cover, when their cover comes out, it matters. It means something. Time Magazine. All right. So the movie is Roma, and before we dive in, we should give you a little dose of context because I'm sure there's some of you who've never heard of this thing and have no idea what we're talking about. So just to bring you up to speed, Roma is a movie that just came out in both theaters and Netflix simultaneously on December 14th, this last Friday. So you have a choice of watching this in Netflix or in theaters, but we highly recommend that you watch it in theaters for reasons we will get to shortly. But anyway, this is a movie that takes place in the 70s, and the main character is a maid to this middle-class family in Mexico City. This is a wealthy family, a lot of privilege, but our perspective is with this maid named Cleo. She's definitely in the lower class than the family that she serves, and she takes care of them. She takes care of these four kids in the family. She works day and night for them, and the movie just follows her as she does her duties for this family, and then it gets personal, where on the side, she has a personal journey that wherein she ends up getting pregnant, and that affects her job and her place in society, and it's also set against the backdrop of a very tumultuous time in Mexico City, where people are literally rioting in the streets, and people are getting killed in the streets around them. So,
would you mind if I call sex a personal journey from now on?
Well, it is a very personal journey.
Well, I think I'm going to talk about it that way from now on.
So that's the movie. It's not heavy on plot. It's a very naturalistic slice of life movie where we follow Cleo and just walk in her shoes for a couple of hours. And I should also say that Roma is a very personal film for the director, who is Alfonso Cuarón. Cuarón actually said in an interview that 90% of this movie comes from his own memories. So this is a very personal film. He too grew up in a very privileged family in Mexico City, had a maid just like Cleo. And he said that he lived in this bubble for most of his childhood. And he loved this woman who was their maid. And then at various points, he realized that the life that she lived was very different than his. And this is kind of his movie to explore what that life might have looked like. So it's a very personal journey for him as well. So let's talk about the director, Alfonso Cuarón. Tim, I know that you are familiar with Cuarón's work, and I think you're a fan of his work. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I like Cuarón.
So what was your appreciation level for Cuarón going in? Do you have any favorite films of his?
So,
what do you think about
it? Yeah, so my favorite film of his is Y Tu Mamá También. A lot of people would like recognize him more from Gravity. But
Sandra
Bullock. I like that film because it's almost like kind of foreshadows this film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I think it's 1990s, early 90s, Mexico, where there's like a political party change for the first time in so long. But basically, it's dealing with sex and death and class and race and like all this stuff in a road trip movie.
Hmm.
And so I really appreciate that movie. There's a lot of sex in it, and that makes it more difficult for a kind of stateside audience.
Yeah, the title and the cover made it seem like it was something about a threesome involving someone's mom, but it is a lot more than that, yes.
It's much more than a threesome with someone's mom.
Yes. Okay, good. I've been meaning to check it out for a really long time. I've heard nothing but great things. So good. What would you say, Cuarón, is there something signature that he brings to his films?
I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but yeah. I think the abandonment of women by men.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And his movies have very strong female characters. I think that's something that you can say, even going back.
Yeah, he does highlight the strength of women.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, the first movie I saw of Alfonso Cuarón's was when I was a kid, and that was A Little Princess, maybe around 10 years old. He directed this movie called A Little Princess, which I loved growing up, and I am proud to say that that movie still holds up to this day, because I showed my three young boys that film, yes, boys, watching a movie called A Little Princess, and they loved it all the way through and were blown away just like I was when I was a kid, and I didn't even know it was directed by Alfonso Cuarón until I rewatched it with them like a year ago, and his name came out at the end. I was like, you gotta be kidding me. And for those of you who are Game of Thrones fans, the father of the main character and A Little Princess is Ser Davos in Game of Thrones, the right-hand man of Stannis Baratheon. So there you go, a young Ser Davos. But that is a childhood favorite. And then another movie that I saw as a young person of Cuarón's was The Prisoner of Azkaban. That's the third entry in the Harry Potter film franchise.
Yep.
And the reason I remember that is that the first two Harry Potters were directed by Chris Columbus, and they were so overly faithful to the books, and it was just like a chore to watch them, because it was like, oh, we've got to get this in, we got to get this. It like literally felt like you were watching him go, well, we couldn't cut that, you know, and it was so just drudgery. But then Alfonso Cuarón came along, and he was the first director in that franchise to begin to take liberties and say, well, we could just cut that out, or even rearrange some of the plot and added all these little flourishes, and J.K. Rowling was okay with it. And so he when he came along, he was the one who began to take that franchise to different heights, and from then on it became a night and day from those first two films.
So I read that Rowling actually preferred, like, said that's her, like, that Cuarón's is her favorite.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
Because Rowling understands, she's a storyteller, she understands that when you are adapting a book, you need to make it the best movie possible. And that means that you might need to change things. And you know, Harry Potter fans went ballistic when their favorite whatever wasn't in it. But you know what? That's what you have to do to adapt a good book to a movie. So
you've got to ignore the geeks.
Exactly.
You got to just go with your gut.
Yeah.
You got to not be faithful. You need to be unfaithfully faithful to narrative.
You simply just want to capture the spirit of the book, and the rest is fair game.
There are things that you can do in a novel or a short story that you cannot translate. And the other way around, too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's evocative things that you can do in a film that you can't do in a novel.
Yep.
And so you're trying to get a point or a feel or a tension or whatever you're trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to, I feel like you have a little bit of liberty, and Cuarón felt that, huh?
Mm-hmm. But moving on, in 2006, you have Children of Men, which is probably my favorite Alfonso Cuarón movie. Tim, did you like that one too?
Yes.
Really? You weren't in love with that one? Because I really liked it. What didn't you like about it?
I liked it.
Okay.
It's just a little bit, I feel like at that time period, there was a apocalyptic kind of genre was like really popular.
That's true.
So everything was like, oh, how are we going to survive the apocalypse when people can no longer A, B, C, and D, mm-hmm, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got to find water. It's like everything's Mad Max at this point. And I think that is super distracting from the point that the film was trying to make. But I do, yeah, I don't know. I don't think he's that great at action, to be honest with you.
I'm with you. It kind of did feel like the premise of that movie was simply to get butts in seats so that he could get to what he was really wanting to focus on. I think that's a fair point. But the one cool thing about Children of Men is that you could look at it like a very non-traditional Christmas movie. And in fact, if you go to our website right now, cinemafaith.com, and you look at the right-hand side of the homepage, there is a review of Children of Men by our friend Nathan Self, who writes about it as an Advent film.
I agree with that. Yeah. It's very Advent-y. Don't like get the family together with some eggnog and watch this.
Right.
Mommy, why did they shoot the daddy?
You're like, it's a rated R film.
It's a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
Like, Christmas story's a little rated R. They're like murdering whole age groups.
The Bible is rated R.
Yeah.
Or worse. Finally, there was Gravity. That was his last big movie before Roma. So you and I saw this together in IMAX. I distinctly remember it, but it was before we were podcasting together. So there is no record of it on the site. We didn't do an episode or anything.
Wait, we saw Gravity in 2010?
Yeah. We saw it at the AMC theaters in IMAX, and I remember it specifically with you. It was just fun. It was just a fun night out. And then
wasn't that 2010?
I think
that's so many years ago.
I know, man. But yeah, we weren't podcasting, so all of our thoughts were just flown into the wind, and they're not recorded.
Not been captured.
But I remember loving that movie, especially on IMAX. It was a visual feast, and it was really fun to watch it on a huge screen. Do you remember liking Gravity?
No, I don't remember watching it with you. Are you sure?
We watched it together. Okay. Oh, jeez.
I'm an old guy. I struggle to remember things.
It's okay.
I eat oatmeal and wear slippers. So
no bathrobe tonight, by the way.
No bathrobe tonight.
Dang it. No, it's okay.
But a sweater-ish thing.
You look more like St. Nick, which is what I was hoping for. So now we get to the main topic of the evening, and that is Roma. So we just went through Alfonso Cuarón's greatest hits, and here we go. So the first thing that you're going to notice about Roma, and it's the reason why you're going to want to skip Netflix and go to the big screen if at all possible, is that this is quite possibly the most beautiful film you're going to look at in 2018. Every single shot is just gorgeous perfection, a work of art. Seriously. Tim, do you agree?
Yeah, it's much more like, it's less like film and more like portraits, like paintings.
Yeah. For sure. And it begins with this opening scene, which I cannot get out of my head. So Cuarón begins with this camera zoomed in on some sort of tile floor. We're just like, okay, what is this? It looks like a tile floor. And the credits are playing out over just this static image of this floor. There's no music. And then we hear water from the distance, and suddenly water comes and floods this floor. And then we actually see a reflection in the water from up above the sky through these like sky windows, and this plane flies overhead. And then the camera pans up for the first time, and we see Cleo is cleaning this driveway of the family that she works for. It's just a beautiful opening scene that kind of represents what's to follow. You're always like big on the first scene. What do you think that first scene is giving us a window into?
So a couple things. Mm-hmm. One is that he has left Cuarón does not live in Mexico. He lives in London.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So he grew up in Mexico City in the neighborhood that's the something Roma neighborhood. So it's like his neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. But he lives in London now. And so that is not where he's from. And so the airplane, some people have interpreted it to be that he is looking back upon this thing, and that he will always look back on this, so that he is the airplane that is in the reflection,
flying over these memories,
Yeah. So that's one of them is the other idea is this, like that floor is like where they park the cars, mm-hmm. to keep people from stealing the cars at night,
right,
or messing with the cars or whatever. So you're in a neighborhood, and a lot of people, especially our listeners who haven't lived in a neighborhood where you'd want to park your cars behind a gate at night, mm-hmm. don't get it. But like a lot of places in the world, like if you leave your car out on the street, you're going to have your windows busted, your stereo taken, or the car will get stolen.
Yep.
And so in this neighborhood, they would park cars in there, but it's also the run for the dogs.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is the dogs will go to the bathroom there and they'll poop. Mm-hmm. And that one of the jobs of the maids in the house is to clean up the dog poop. Mm-hmm. And so the first scene is the maid cleaning up dog poop. She's cleaning it up. She's washing the floor. She's doing the worst job of the worst jobs that there are, which is cleaning up the dog poop and then scrubbing with a broom and cleanser.
Yeah.
Scrubbing the carport so that there can be a car parked there. And that's one of her jobs.
And she can never do it fast enough because, I mean, you know,
there's like two or three dogs
going,
right?
All day. And then, yeah, the car comes at night and there's two more and they happen to step in it and they yell at her for not getting the dog poop, right? And it's like,
So it's like her daily chore. Mm-hmm. But that out of that, like that place, which is kind of like a cage. So like he's into cages. I don't know if you notice that. There's birds in cages. Mm-hmm. Everything looks like a cage. Their house where these maids are looks like a cage, like a bird cage.
Interesting. Yeah.
And we at first go, oh, so keep these people in. And then you're like, no, it's also to keep poor people out.
Huh.
And so there's this choice to live in a cage because there's fear.
And every time they open the gate to let the car out or whatever, they always have to go get the dog. Like that's always a big thing. Keep the dog out or keep the dog out. And you kind of begin to see some parallels between Cleo and this life of the dog where she's free, but is she?
You know? Yeah.
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 So the opening scene is just stunning. It's just visual poetry right from the get-go. And what's really interesting is that Cuarón typically works with our favorite cinematographer working today, Emmanuel Lubezki. Lubezki worked with him on Y Tu Mama Tambien and Gravity, and won an Oscar for Gravity with Cuarón as the director. And of course, Lubezki also works with Alejandro Iñárritu, which is one of our favorite directors. But he started working with Cuarón on this film. They did pre-production together, and it ended up that the shooting schedule was going to be over like 100 days, and Lubezki had to drop out and go do something else before they could even shoot anything. And so Cuarón ended up taking all the cinematography duties on himself. And it's kind of ironic because there's a lot of talk that he's going to be nominated for an Oscar, and he did it without his right-hand man, Lubezki, who's usually the golden boy for him. So
makes me wonder what it would be like if Lubezki was here.
Oh, yeah. It would be even more over the top. Awesome. Yeah.
I mean, I thought the cinematography was amazing.
It really was.
Yeah. But I'm also... If Lubezki's involved in a project, it's like...
Yeah, I know.
it's it will be stunning.
I think the last Lubezki film we saw was The Revenant with him and Iñárritu.
Saw Last Days in the Desert, didn't we?
Oh, yeah. Man, I can't wait till Iñárritu makes another film. I think after The Revenant, it was such an arduous shoot that he was basically like, I'm taking a vacation for a very long time. And so, when he comes out with another one, we'll see. So as you can tell from that first scene, Roma is a very naturalistic movie. The only sounds you hear are the sounds of what the characters hear. There's no artificial score happening in the background. And it's just all about immersing ourselves in Cleo's world. We hear what she hears. And I actually found the sound to be really surprising at times because obviously, theaters are surround sound. And so I would hear someone like shouting in the back corner of the theater. I'd be like, is there some guy like shouting something? And no, it was the movie. Like I was kept being shocked by the dialogue. And I think it's just because we're so used to music kind of being the foundation of everything that's always happening that we don't notice dialogue like this film makes you notice dialogue, And it's the same with the visuals. This is very natural. The camera just glides and follows Cleo wherever she goes. And it's just like it's all about real life in that way. It's kind of episodic because it's just following her life. She cleans the driveway, she wakes up, kids to school, they go to a party, et cetera. And it eventually does. There is a bit of a narrative that forms with this big event that happens to her. It's definitely not mundane. It's every scene has something colorful happening in it, but it's always a choice of natural over any artificial narrative. Yeah. That's kind of the naturalism of the film. And as far as acting is concerned, the woman who plays Cleo is Yalitza Aparicio, and this is her very first movie. I can't believe it. She's never done anything else. This is it. And she's really good in it. What do you think about her as the character?
She's good. I think one of the things that if you look at why did he pick her, she's very Mayan features. She's very Indian.
Yeah.
Her skin is noticeably darker. So the idea is they're creating, and she speaks I forgot what it's called, Mixtal or whatever, or Mix, I can't remember. But basically a different dialect that's Indian and Spanish kind of combined. I guess that's more indigenous is my understanding.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're just letting you know. She's trying to be authentic that there is she is very much they picked a very kind of legitimately authentic kind of actress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And her features are very definitely Mayan.
Yeah. But she handles the part well. Yeah. She's very natural in it, and she hits all the right notes, and she very well might get an Oscar nomination for her very first movie, which is crazy.
I like her because it's a mix of innocence and strength.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think that's what they were going for. She's never portrayed in a way that is simple.
Hmm.
She has a super strong sense of a strong depth to her.
Mm-hmm.
And even though she's uneducated, likely cannot read, likely, all these things that, we would value, she's very solid. She's centered.
Yeah. And there's always something more going on behind what she presents. And that's hard to portray for a seasoned actor, let alone someone who's very first film. So it's very impressive.
Yeah. There's several scenes that there's a scene where they're asking about her sexual history when she gets pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And she plays that scene. That's one of the perfect scenes in the movie because she's super dignified and she doesn't want to answer directly. So she's very indirect in the way she answers.
Yes.
That scene alone was it was so perfect.
For sure.
Cause you can feel that she's uncomfortable, but also strong at the same time. And she doesn't want to break a social moor, but you can tell she also is so honest that she's going to say the honest answer. It's really cool.
So, Tim, I want to dive right into some themes of the movie. And as we move deeper into this, we can bring up some specific examples from the film and get into some of the more standout scenes. So as we look at Roma through the lens of cinema faith, what are some truths that you feel Caron is dialing up here for us?
So one of the themes, and this is one of his themes that's not just in this movie, but it's also in Children of Men. It's the Pietà theme, like Michelangelo's sculpture, La Pietà or whatever.
I'm not familiar with that. Can
so
you describe it?
So it's where Christ is already dead. He's off the cross and Mary is like holding, it's like a young Mary, which is kind of weird. Mm. She's holding the dead Christ. Mm. And there's like a lot of interpretations of it. But the idea is that he's abandoned her in some ways. Like, that's how Caron is interpreting, is that, like, even Mary was abandoned by a man, which is like, whoa.
Yeah.
And so that there's something that is kind of part of being a woman is to be abandoned by men.
Hmm. The mother of the household says that at one point when she's drunk and kind of stumbles into the evening, she's like, we're always alone. Just remember that, Cleo. We're always alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Women are always alone. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you see it. Yeah, you see that throughout. Like in a lot of his stuff, like even in like Gravity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Alone.
She's alone. Most
She's
of the
alone.
Movie.
Yeah. Right.
Even in A Little Princess, going all the way back to one of his first films. How about that?
Yeah. So that's like one of those big themes. The other, the kind of converse of that is that women are strong enough to be abandoned, which I don't know if I like agree with all that, but I think those are what he is showing us.
Yeah. And it's not just women. It's also kind of, Cleo represents people from a lower class of society too, right? And I think this movie in a lot of ways is giving voice to a very voiceless group of people that are all around us. And in some ways, even though this isn't an immigrant story, Cleo kind of resembles kind of an immigrant story of what, or in, you know, as we would relate to it in America. These are, Cleo represents the people that clean our hotel rooms, that are changing the trash in the office. You know?
But what we're used to in America is Horatio Alger tales, which I don't know. Mm-hmm. Horatio Alger was a kind of like a dime store novelist kind of person. But the tales are generally like, okay, somebody starts out really poor, uneducated, and they work really, really hard and they get to some level, right? So we love, like, I'm thinking of like, what's that Will Smith movie where he becomes a stockbroker based on real life? So whatever.
He did a Rubik's Cube and all that.
Yeah, but we love those movies. We love movies where somebody starts from nothing and becomes something great.
Pursuit of Happiness.
And because they're kind of spectacular, right? Pursuit of Happiness, yeah. Yeah, I mean, even using like American constitutional language.
Yeah. With a Y and which spelled is funny wrong that's, because
yeah. He, yeah. So I think there's some key scenes in this movie. One of them is where there was all of those kind of paramilitary guys that are working out, like they're being trained by martial artists and wrestlers and all this other stuff.
Such
in a
weird
field.
Scene. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the guy that's training him says, do you want to see something that's completely amazing? He like sets him up, something that you can, that you've never seen before. Mm-hmm. And he stands on one leg and he puts his hands above his head
and he gets blindfolded.
And he's blindfolded.
You think he's going to like levitate or something.
You just don't know what he's going to do. Yeah. And he takes one foot off the ground and puts it on his knee. So his knee's like a triangle, you know, pointing outward. And nobody is amazed by that. They're just like, what? Hmm. And he's like, what were you waiting for? Me to levitate or to, you know, fly or something? You know, mm-hmm. He said, go ahead, try it. And you see 200-300 guys that cannot do it. And he said, you watched a miracle right here, but you didn't realize that this was amazing. And then they show the women who are behind all the men.
Yeah.
And the protagonist in this, Cleo, she can do it.
She's the only one who
can do
it.
She's the only one that can do it.
Yeah.
And that whole scene exists because there are these amazing things that we do not see because we do not think they are miraculous. And we see them all around us and we don't see the strength that it takes to do them.
Hmm.
And I love, like, that is kind of like the key to the whole thing.
Yes.
And so that somebody like Quarone, I mean, he's basing this on the person that he grew up with, but somebody that seems inconsequential in a story, a side character, a maid, mm-hmm. might be actually the person that's doing the most difficult thing of all and deserves to be a protagonist in a film.
And how often do we make movies about people like Cleo? Hardly ever. Yeah.
Right. Or we try to, the other way we could do it with Cleo is that we can do the Horatio Alger take, right?
Mm-hmm.
or we can say even like precious. We tend to like try to exploit. Mm. We tend to try
based on a novel by Sapphire.
Yes. We tend to try to exploit the person that's strong, but in this movie, they're just strong.
Yep.
So we're not like, oh, don't you feel bad for her?
Yeah.
There's like not really a scene where like I'm feeling bad for her. She's strong in every scene. So even when she's being like berated, she doesn't back down. She's just like sits there.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll get yelled at by the employers and she doesn't like, you can tell she's like, eh, whatever.
Yeah.
What's the next move? You know, it's just kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm. Her strength, her humility, her dignity in that is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of, I feel like that this was really like a tribute to this person in Cuarón's life who had such an impact, who was able to do something that's miraculous that nobody saw.
Hmm. So you mentioned the plane flying overhead, and I think that's really cool about how like Cuarón looking at his past memories. I think that's totally probably what it is. And I know this might be a stretch, but as I was watching it, I was wondering if there might be an element where the plane represents kind of God watching over Cleo's life in a way that no one else around her is. Because when you look through scripture, you see that God does actually tend to play favorites. He has a tendency on zeroing in on the weakest among us, the outcast, the poor, and while we turn all our attention, of course, to strong, powerful, attractive people, and God is always the one that's like, you know, no, I choose the shepherd boy that Jesse didn't even think to bring to the lineup for Samuel to look at, you know, I choose that child that you're trying to turn away from me. And it's so easy for us to say, well, like if we were there, we wouldn't have ignored that person, you know, shame on the Pharisees and the disciples, but we ignore those people every day. Just even the guy with the sign while we're waiting for the light to turn green, you know, to the right of our car. And I feel like God throughout scripture is very specially focused on people like Cleo who are kind of carrying the weight of the world and is being ignored by everyone around her. And so I'm wondering if that's kind of God watching out for Cleo in a way that only she can see. And there's kind of a Mary element to Cleo, you know, like what you were saying with that painting is there is kind of, there's the pregnancy of course, but there's just kind of this idea that there is a spark of the divine on her that no one else can see.
Part of me wonders if it's Cuarón that's abandoned her.
Ooh.
So the idea is that he left too, yet another man. And in some ways, he is her son more than anything else.
And the movie's almost like penance, sort of.
Well, she wakes the kids up. Right. Even the hard-boiled egg scene. Do you remember that? Or soft-boiled egg scene?
No.
There's a scene where she soft-boils the egg. She cracks the egg. She pours the egg out really carefully into this bowl. She like did all this work to get it right where it is. And then the mom of the kids feeds the kids the egg real quick.
Hmm.
But the idea is like, who's the real mother?
Right. Cause she wakes up even before the mother of the household wakes up. Right.
Right.
Exactly.
And it's so she is the mother
mm-hmm.
and then she's abandoned. So I also think Cuarón abandons her.
Hmm.
So it's like, that's his real mother in some ways. Like he is his mother,
yeah.
biological.
Yeah.
But who raised him? Who suffered for him? Who gave up for him?
Uh-huh.
It's Cleo. But I think that the plain idea is that he's abandoned her.
Yeah. All right, Tim. So we got into a bit of a fiery texting war last night. So let's just go ahead and lay our cards on the table. So you called this movie a masterpiece.
Yes.
And I gave it an A-, and you were very upset about that. And so we're going to have it out. Now, I know this is kind of a dumb argument from the outset, because look, we're both saying this is an incredible film. An A-, I give out a handful of those every year. So I'm totally in agreement with you that this is a dynamite film. I just can't get to the level of masterpiece for reasons I will present, but I want you to go first. So why is Roma a masterpiece? Present your case.
Okay. So we can go through. Well, first off, it has the feel of a 1960s Italian film.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought of, and thinking of what, like a Fellini, like I thought of Knights of Calabria. I thought of The Bicycle Thieves. There's just something about it that is so story driven, so character driven. And then every shot is well planned. It's a beautiful portrait, every shot. I also think it's full of symbolism. It has tons of religious meaning to it. And it is doing something that has been done, but not quite so well before, which is saying that the things that we cannot see in a character or the characters that we think are the side characters could very well be the main characters.
Hmm.
so that we're so used to, like, they, like one of the things that they do in the film is they take heroic male figures and they kind of mock them.
That's true.
So
they're the weakest members of the
They're the weakest film. Members in the film. So like
Furman.
Well, there's Furman. He's weak, but he's like a martial arts guy, right? So he's like always showing off how good he is at like martial arts. But in reality, he can't even like face the fact that he got someone pregnant.
Yep.
So he's like weak. Yeah. But there's other people, like just simple, like little symbolic people. The guy that's trying to pull a car with his teeth. And that's considered a feat of strength.
That's right.
Which I think is funny because they're mocking feats of strength. They're like, okay, yeah. So he pulled a car with his teeth for like 10 feet. But this woman is like basically pregnant out of wedlock, caring for an entire family. She's doing this over a course of how many years?
Yeah.
Like that is a feat of strength. Yeah. But nobody sees it because it seems too normal. Hmm. So I feel like the way that they set all that up is pretty amazing, saying like, no, we have strength all wrong. Or even like our soldiers, like they have, I think one of the key things is when you have that clash, which is a real historical event in 1971 or whatever, in Mexico City, where they like over 100 and something people died. Mm. But the idea is that would military, like shooting people, does that make you a man? Like, cause you know, I mean, these are like all the, like, is that power? And this would say, no, there's like a deeper power. So I think it's like really beautiful. I think you've done a great job with that. It reminded me of Moonlight in some ways, which is so outside of like your typical, like who protagonist or whatever, that you have to, it makes you question a lot of things. So I really think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's emotionally driven, but also just so technically sound and so philosophical at the same time. So rarely do you have something that's like high philosophy, high theology, and then also be emotionally compelling and beautiful at the same time. So it meets aesthetic standards. Ba-doom, 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 ba-doom. Yeah, but go ahead. Tell me what you think.
Okay. So I completely agree that from an aesthetic standpoint, this is a phenomenal piece of art that looks like it just like Tim said, it looks like this came out of a time capsule from the 60s and or 70s that you just, it has that look and feel of an instant classic, that you're watching something important, something that is going to be talked about in film schools from a technical standpoint. But if we're going to talk about a perfect grade, okay, this is, I take this very seriously. A perfect film for me, every single element has to be firing on all cylinders. Every single box has to be checked. This is a perfect grade. So what is checked for me is the technical elements. There's no question about it. But from a narrative vantage point, I feel like the story could have had a little more oomph to it. And I realized that the subtlety is part of the power. The fact that Cleo's story is a bit ordinary is kind of the whole point. But again, if we're talking about a perfect film, I need a story that grabs me all the way through with a powerful beginning, middle, and end. And if I'm looking at the masterpieces from the last few years, like Moonlight, La La Land, Birdman, Whiplash, all of them have both artistic perfection and a story that gripped me and never let go. And I did not feel that with Roma. I respect the subtlety. I respect the nuance. But that is the only thing that's keeping me from going over the top and calling this a masterpiece.
You want the guy pulling the car with the teeth.
No,
and what
not.
You've been presented with is a maid.
Oh, man.
So I think, you're falling victim to like your culture.
Maybe.
And that you have certain expectations that white male culture has put on movies that you're playing into. Now, that said, I think that what you're mistaking for lack of plot arc is excessive detail.
Okay.
So one of the things, which I think is probably a legitimate critique, which would be if you actually live this, you're going to add detail to this that is unnecessary to the tension in the film.
Yes.
So, and it feels more dreamy, actually, because it's so real. It's almost like a dream. It's weird. It's like you're around the corner here. Mm-hmm. But I think there's so much detail that it had to have happened. Mm-hmm. You know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Versus like most of these things are like, okay, don't move. The dinosaur is going to eat us if we move.
Right. No, I'm
so
with
like
you.
Every piece of dialogue is necessary.
Yeah.
What I would say is this film to be authentic, to be true, is not going to have every part of like, just like real life. Like every ounce of our dialogue does not lead to a tension situation. So, like, there are wasted things in this movie.
Yeah.
And I would say wasted because for the sake, not wasted in the sense of wasted if you were, like, a screenwriter who's trying to write Lethal Weapon 2 or something, right? But Wasted, that it's more like a novel where you have detail and you have, there's some things that are emphatic that can either function as a symbol, but sometimes they don't even function as a symbol. But I think that's because it is like straight from his experience.
But that kind of goes back to what we were talking about with Chris Columbus and Harry Potter, right? I mean, you have to translate your memories into a movie that works as a compelling movie. And I'm not saying it's not compelling. I'm just saying that there could have been more of that, of that missing element that makes a movie over the top, right? Like, okay, so
let's go through Hero's Quest then. And well, let's see if it falls through. Like, let's see if this can like meet the criteria and just might have a little extra flourishes. Because is there not an inciting incident for both women? Husband leaves, mm-hmm. The other one gets pregnant. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then there's a journey. What is the journey for each one?
I know what you're saying. It's there.
Then they find a power inside them that they didn't know they had.
Yeah.
Then they exercise that power and they take some kind of life risk. They risk their life in some way. And as a result, they find out something about themselves that they didn't know before.
Done. You may be able to fit it loosely into the hero's journey, but it does not come out with the same effect as the great films that I would give an A+ class to.
So do they need to wear a whip and be an architect? Listen, that's a sex. I mean, an archaeologist that's a sexist to like meet your criteria.
You mentioned authenticity. Okay, well, I watched this film with a friend, and he was talking about 70s kind of that. This reminded him of like their Italian kind of ultra realistic 70s movies, and he was even saying Andy Warhol made movies, which I did not know, but he was a director in Hollywood films, and he made a movie called Empire. Okay, and do you know what that movie was? It was him putting a camera in front of the Empire State Building and watching people come in and out of the Empire State Building for 6 hours, and the movie was called Empire.
That's not this
and
film.
That was called art. Now listen, I'm not saying that that's what Rome. I'm not saying that that's what this is. I'm just saying if the continuum of powerful is at the very end, this thing that could barely be called art because it's literally people walking in and out of a building, and at the other end is the movie that I talk about every time we get together, Schindler's List. Okay, for me, as far as the barriers of greatness, I would say Roma falls somewhere in the middle of that continuum of we have to be authentic. And that's just, you know, all our dialogue can't lead to blah, 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 your standard Hollywood, whatever. But that's what's missing. So when you talk about Schindler's List, I saw it again when it was re-released in theaters a couple weeks ago, at the beginning of December. That is another gorgeous black and white film that I think artistically is totally comparable to Roma. But what is the element that made me see it a dozen times, that made me race back to the theater 2 weeks ago to see it again? It's the story. It's Spielberg taking us on a journey about Oscar Schindler, who only cares about money, and he makes a factory, and he uses his factory to make money, but then he is so horrified by the Holocaust that he uses his factory to save lives, ending in a climactic scene where he could have saved more if he had only cared sooner. That is why I've watched that movie over and again, and why I probably will never watch Roma again, even though I respect it.
So what you just described was a powerful white man who, because he's in a place of white privilege, can save a group of people that are not in that position. Is that correct?
In that particular,
it's exactly what
that,
it is
in that case.
No, this is not going to meet that criteria, but there's no way it can meet that criteria because it's actually the opposite message. The message is that the people who are the white privileged people are being saved by this person. Mm. So it's a totally opposite message. So it's not going to fit into the Schindler's List category. And so like, I would say like, this is groundbreaking because of that. Because what you're getting in Schindler's List, and I think, you know, God bless Oscar Schindler and his descendants or whatever. And I think that was, I mean, it's powerful, right? Because he saves lives. And I see that I think you see that same thing, but you see that it's from somebody who's been abandoned, right? Mm-hmm. Ends up saving this family in some ways, even though she is denied a family herself, which is like, whoa.
Yeah.
I just think it's different. It's more philosophical, but I don't think the other end of the spectrum is the Warhol film, because that's more like performance art.
Okay.
What I would say the other end of the spectrum would be is Malick, non-story Malick movies.
There you go. Sure.
And so my thoughts on that would be, this is not that. Like, this says,
it's not,
like
for sure.
This keeps, I watched it twice. Like, yeah. I would never do that with some of the Malick movies. Watch it twice. Malick movies are heavy, philosophical, miserable movies. This is very much emotionally driven with character development. and it meets a lot of other criteria. I would say it's a little dreamy. I would say it does not have economy to it.
Okay.
So I would say, no, it lacks economy. But I'd say because it does, and Cuarón picks those details correctly. So for instance, like your favorite scene is like it doesn't have any economy. It does not play into any tension. It's just pure, what does it do? Nothing, right?
It's true.
But I'd say it's also the part that moved you. So right. It's like,
right. I'm with yeah. you. And I'm not, I don't want anyone to get the wrong impression. I'm not saying that there has to be some cookie cutter script for me to appreciate a movie. One of my favorite, as you've mentioned Malick, one of my favorite movies of all time and my top five of all time is Tree of Life. And that doesn't follow a traditional Hollywood formulaic script, but that hits heights. Emotionally, that Roma never hit for me. It blew my mind, that film. And I just didn't get that same power. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it has to be Oscar Schindler. I'm saying that it has to have that same knock you over the head power and resonance for me to say that is a masterpiece.
So that's like exactly what the guy was trying to show you when he was standing on one foot. He was saying,
or pull the car with his teeth.
He's like, you don't think that Cuarón has done that, but he did.
Mm.
Go ahead and try to do what Cuarón did.
Ouch.
Like that's really like, that's the message of the film is like, sometimes the things that are not spectacular actually are.
Let me close the debate by asking you this. One of the books you gave me for my birthday once was Story by Robert McKee. What would you think McKee would say about Roma?
He would say that not every scene has tension. He would say that not every scene is critical, and that if you wanted to edit Roma down to 120 instead of 210 or whatever it is, or two, it's like 220. So if you took 20 minutes out of Roma, you could probably do that.
So you're saying it goes back to economy for him, probably.
Yeah, because you'd want to have every piece of dialogue would have to have a point.
Yep.
But you'd also be lacking some of the details. You go, well, I wonder if they would do the scene on the rooftop where they both say, I kind of like being dead.
Yeah, which is beautiful.
I wonder if there would be... If we cut out one of the vignettes, maybe they wouldn't go to the beach. Maybe they wouldn't go to we wouldn't see the fire.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there are, I think that he would say, oh, this lacks economy. I also like the pace of this film because one of the things that I feel like, I think the slower pacing is actually jarring to younger audience. And I think in a way that makes it meditative. And so I don't think I would, when you're not constantly in tension, you have to think about stuff. So there's a scene, right? Like right after she cleans the dog poop, right after the first scene, you're watching her do chores, and then the camera stops. She goes in a door and just stops. And there's birds in cages. And there's no explanation of it. It's like you just watched her like leave a cage. And you're looking and there's birds in cages all around her. It's like Snow White, but with cages. Like that's exactly the film, right?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, it's Snow White. And she's like one of these birds that's in the, and she's surrounded by these animals, la, 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 la. But there's birds in the cages and she's also in a cage.
And then she comes right back out of the room she was
comes
in
out
after
of the cage.
That. Yeah, exactly.
And then she's in another cage. Even the carport's a cage.
Yeah.
Her house is a cage. Everything looks like a cage around her. And so I think, like, so you don't have that. There was no tension in that scene. There was no economy to that scene. But at the same time, it was so slow that it made us go, oh, I see what they're saying. But not so slow that you're like miserable.
Right. For sure.
Like Terrence Malick miserable.
All right, Tim, what are your final thoughts on Roma? Go.
So I think it's great. I do think you're, so one of the things that McKee doesn't say that this type of film is bad. He would say that it won't be popular. But I don't think that that's like the criteria for the Academy Awards.
For sure. Of course not.
And so while a lot of people probably saw Gravity because that's a popcorn movie, and they probably, you know, they're, oh my gosh, I've never seen that special effect before. I couldn't believe it. I think that for a tenth of the price, they'll see this film on, and a lot of times on Netflix, right? And I think it can be very rewarding, but I don't think it's ever going to be, I don't think this film will be popular, but I think it's a great film. So I think with McKee, he's not saying it's a bad film. He's saying that nobody's going to watch it. Just like The Bicycle Thief, right? Incredible film.
You showed it to me and it was a great film.
But it's popular with like who? Film geeks.
Right.
Like people aren't like going to line up for it. And if it shows in a theater, like, you know, it'll be like a handful of people who are like, oh, I can't believe it. I feel like this film may be in that category.
And so you'd give it a straight A?
Oh, like a grade? Yeah.
Would you even go A plus? Do you already sense this is a classic? That's my version of an A plus.
Yeah, will it stand up? Yeah. Yes, it will stand up.
Okay. There you go. So as I said, Roma gets a hearty A- for me. And that's no small thing. I want to emphasize only five movies have gotten an A- for me in 2018. I haven't given any film a perfect grade. And for those who are curious, my top five movies of the year are, in order, You Were Never Really Here with Joaquin Phoenix, which you can watch on Amazon Prime. Did you see it?
No. Yeah, I did see it. I thought it was all right, but everybody around me thinks it's great. I have to watch it again. I'll watch it again.
It's the best movie I've seen this year. I'm glad that you saw it once, but yes, watch it again. You watched Roma twice. Give me one more try on You Were Never Really Here.
Okay.
Okay. So that's number one for me. Number two is The Favorite, and number three is Roma, and number four is First Man, and rounding out the top five is Won't You Be My Neighbor.
So you're saying in December, Roma has made three, even though we had these disagreements?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's why I was said that my that our argument was basically semantics, because I'm agreeing with you that it is a phenomenal film.
Oh,
I'm just saying it's not an A+ masterpiece. That's all I'm saying.
So if,
yeah,
what was last year's best picture? Was it Shape of Water?
Last year's best picture was Shape of Water. Oh my gosh, I almost blocked that out of my memory.
So which he's worked. He actually produced Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, okay.
Cuarón did.
Yeah, he's friends with Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah. So if I put this film against Shape of Water,
I would take this any day over.
Yeah, me too.
Of course.
So that's a big thing to say. So like, I would think this film beats out last year's. But is that last year's best picture?
Yes, that was last year's best picture. I cannot believe it, but it was.
So I think this your number three is. We both agree it easily beats out. Yeah. So
yeah, does it beat Lady Bird?
Yeah, it does. Oh yeah, like
here we
like
go,
100, like 100 times over.
Here we
yeah.
go.
Yep.
It doesn't.
No, it does.
No, it doesn't, because Lady Bird is an A, and that is a great film. And
you can love Lady Bird, and that's all right with me. I don't mind that, but that's don't have to agree.
That's fine. I love it. Anyway, so Roma's in great company, and it's a great film, and you need to go see it. See it in the theater if you absolutely can, because of the visuals. It is just so breathtaking, and like I mentioned with the dialogue in the background, it's a truly immersive experience in the theater. But if you can't make it, there is Netflix. It's on Netflix, and you can watch it right now. You can click pause on this podcast and go watch Roma on Netflix right now.
If I had time right now, I don't.
Yeah.
If I had time right now, I would go see it in the theater.
Oh, it's so breathtaking. Yep. Yes. So this will be a much talked about movie on Oscar night, and you can watch it right now. So go see it. So, all right. As we wrap up, I promised that we were going to close with the question. Tim, I hope in the back of your mind, you've been thinking about your answer. It's Christmas Eve. You can only watch two Christmas movies. What are they going to be?
Oh my gosh. All right, it's Christmas. So Christmas Eve is a tough question. All right, but I will do my best here.
Yeah.
Okay, so I can watch two movies. It's A Wonderful Life.
Okay.
Okay, so because I just think it's a classic one. And then it's the 52 Christmas Carol? I can't remember which one it is. It's like the classic one that everybody thinks is the best actor.
Uh-huh.
So I pick those two.
All right.
What about you?
Fair enough. Are you ready to throw something at my head? First up would be Muppets Christmas Carol.
Every year, John. Every year.
Listen. First of all, I have kids, and I would probably be watching with them. It's still early in the evening, so that's partly my defense. And secondly, it's the fact that that movie reminds me of my childhood, because I grew up watching that version. I've not even, I know this is heresy, even seen the correct version that you're referring to, the 1958 version. I've not seen
52?
It. 52. One of those.
There's so many.
I'm sorry. I know that probably, of course, there are probably better versions of A Christmas Carol, but I grew up watching Muppets Christmas Carol. I think it is a very well done movie. It hits me every time. It's very powerful. It's very life affirming. I love that movie, and my kids love that movie. All right. I'm sorry. But number two, and far less controversial, is It's a Wonderful Life. That is the Christmas movie. I watch it every year. I cry every year, and it always reminds me of what's important in life. So we are in complete agreement that It's a Wonderful Life is the way to
Capra,
go.
And I don't even like Capra.
Of course.
I don't even like Capra. He's a creepy dude, but you know what?
It's the movie.
It's a good movie.
Yep. So there you have it. That is our last show in December. Hey, for those of you looking to give us a Christmas gift, thanks. Here's all we want. Flip over on your iPhone to rate us on iTunes. That's it. All you have to do is go to your podcast app, give us a 5-star rating, leave a review, and hey, why not in your review tell us what your two favorite Christmas movies are that you would watch on Christmas
Eve. Would you watch? Is everybody? Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think are some that they might like?
I don't know, but I'm curious to read the responses. And in fact, if you leave us a review mentioning your two Christmas movies, we will read them out loud on the next podcast. That's a promise. And from the bottom of our hearts, we just want to say thank you to everyone who has taken the time to listen to us in 2018. Those of you who take an hour out of your month every single month, thank you so much. And even those who've just listened a couple times, we are so glad that you're a part of our audience. And it means the world to us that our conversations could mean something to you. So thank you. As we near the end of the year, we really appreciate you being a part of our family. And Tim, you're the best, man. I love doing this every month with you. It's so great.
You're the best, John. I appreciate it. And it's always good to talk about film. And like I told you before the podcast, God sometimes speaks to me through film.
Oh, absolutely. All the time for me.
Yeah. And I would hope that our listeners feel the same way.
Yep. So I hope you have a wonderful Christmas with your family. And I'll see you in 2019.
Sounds good.
Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next year.